Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. I'm Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Hi, Fiona. Can you believe that we have reached the end of our season?
I can believe it because we've been working hard over the last few weeks to get it done. It's the end of season six. It's the end of our third year of podcasting.
I can't believe it. I really cannot believe it.
I feel like we're going strong, and I'm especially excited for our next season.
Me too, on several levels. I think we've got some really exciting guests that we're hoping for. Nobody lined up yet, but we've got a exciting wish list, and we've got a bit of an exciting project.
Indeed, indeed. I wonder if I should go into that, because at this point we normally talk about how our writing week has been going. And I wanted to talk about shiny new thing syndrome, which I've been suffering from a bit lately. And it is directly related to our new project, which is, you know, when you're doing something and it should really have your full attention, and you get a new idea and you become completely obsessed with that new idea. Mm. And the project that you and I are starting to work on, how much can we say about it at this stage, do you think?
I think we've got to leave them hanging, Fiona. I think we'll have more detail by our next season. We'll be able to be more realistic. I mean, who knows? Maybe we're going to come on at the beginning of the next season and go, well, that went came to nothing. So I don't want to curse us by saying too much, but let's just go watch the space and hope everybody will watch the space.
Well, I am certainly watching the space because I've just become fascinated and obsessed and can't think about anything else. And it is a bit of a problem, you know, when you have projects on the go and you become too fixated on the shiny new thing, you can allow yourself to become distracted. And we actually need the discipline, because the shiny new thing will become the boring old thing after a while, because every long form project becomes dull to the creator after when you've been in it long enough. But you need the discipline, unless you just want to have hundreds of unfinished projects littering your career. You need the discipline to finish the thing that you've started.
100%. And every shiny new thing is shiny and new until you actually have to work on it.
Yes.
And it's the working where the shine starts wearing off. So let's see what we're saying about it once we're deep, deep, deep into the shiny new thing. But I walk around with a notebook in case I have shiny new thing ideas. So I am also fairly distracted.
How has your writing week been?
I've had quite an interesting thing happen. So we know that my modus operandi is that I write 500 words a day when I'm going well, sometimes less, but I'm all about the word count per day. And I was reaching the end of a book, and I realized that for some reason it wasn't working for me anymore. And I found myself using time instead of words.
Right.
And going, I have 20 minutes before my next meeting. Mm-hmm. I will write in those 20 minutes, and I will write nonstop in those 20 minutes. I'm at that phase because it's near the end of a book. You don't have to stop and think what's going to happen next, because I'm now on that very downhill slope where you know what's got to happen next because you've got to get to the end of the book, and I know how the book ends. So I would write for 20 minutes, and I have to say, I don't know if this will be true in an ongoing way. I write more than 500 words.
Oh, wow.
So the time is working better, because then I get to, so maybe I reach 500 words at 16 minutes. And then I'm like, no, you've got four more minutes. You keep writing. You had 20 minutes to write. You write for 20 minutes. So it's been a very productive system for me now. Have I discovered the new way I'm going to write forever? I don't know.
I love it. I think I'm going to give it a go. And what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
Another interesting one. I've had an interesting week. I am going to make a confession now, and it's a bad confession, but I am not a Rachel Joyce fan. And it's a bad confession, particularly because I've interviewed her and expressed great joy at interviewing her. And I don't hate her books by any means, but nothing's caught me the way they seem to have caught other people. So then we got in book club The Homemade God, which is her latest book. And I love the cover. You have this epic family scenario. There is a father who is a very strong character. He has four children. We learn about all the children. We get to know all of the children, all of their stories, all of their points of view. The father has met a new woman, and she is complicated and it's mysterious. There's more mystery in it than there usually is in one of her books. Like, what's going to happen? What happened? The father is a complicated artist. Maybe that was part of it for me, although my father was not a complicated artist, just an artist. But it's very – I was completely gripped and compelled. Interestingly, reading reviews, it seems to be that people who love the Beatles – do not love this book. And people who've loved her other previous books do not love this book. And vice versa. A lot of people who didn't love her previous books have loved this book. It feels like she's written a completely different type of book. I'll be very interested what you think of it.
Well, I'm definitely going to read it. It's queued up and ready. I'm so, so curious.
And what have you been reading or listening to or doing while that sits in your queue waiting for you?
I have been reading. I've been on a bit of a reading tear. I ripped through Wally Lamb's The River is Waiting. I am currently reading Kazuo Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, but the book I actually want to talk about is Audition by Katie Kitamura. It's on the shortlist for the Booker Prize. It is a short book divided into two parts, and I think you would enjoy it because it's a sliding doors book.
Ooh.
It's two possible realities for the same character, and they hinge on a live theatre performance, that something that happens in the live theatre performance seems to spark the possibility of this alternate reality. And to me, the second reality actually felt more real than the first reality. That for me is the real version, in inverted commas. But it's so clever. It's so well done. She's an absolutely masterful storyteller. So I'd recommend it to anyone. I really would. If you want to say, I've read one of the shortlisted Booker novels, that is the one for you.
Fiona, are you a person who reads the shortlist actively, or did you just happen to read this?
I have become the person who reads the shortlist. I think now that my children are grown up, I've got more time. I'm being more intentional about my reading, less haphazard. And I'm going through them. I've even touched on some of the long-listed books. But, it's been very rewarding so far. I did it last year as well.
I had one year where I started from the long list.
Mm-hmm.
And I found I was so disappointed in the short list based on my long list reading. And I hated I hadn't been able to read the winner. And I often find I can't read the winner.
Oh, interesting.
And so Booker Prize has become for me a bit of a, don't read this book, it's going to be incomprehensible.
Right.
So I'm interested and I will give this a try.
I'm positive that you are going to like that one. So an author who has had a long and distinguished and incredibly interesting career and whose books you can dip in at random and be sure of being rewarded is our guest today. Our guest today is Laurie Kubutsile. Laurie is a Botswana-based author who was born in the United States. Laurie has a long and distinguished career as an author, which spans children's books, picture books for children, books for older children, many books that have been prescribed for schools. She has written a series of humorous young adult novels, including Signed Hopelessly in Love and Signed The Secret Keeper. She has written a series of detective novellas, and she has written two novels for Penguin Random House, which are, I would say, historical literary fiction, including The Scattering and But Deliver Us From Evil. Laurie has won the Golden Baobab Prize twice for children's writing. She's been shortlisted for the Kane Prize, and she won the Best International Fiction Prize at the Sharjah International Book Fair in 2017 for The Scattering. I've only touched on the highlights of Laurie's career, But we are so excited to have her talking to us today from Botswana. Laurie, hi and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Laurie, you know what's going to happen next. We are going to ask you, how has your writing week been?
You know, you asked me on the exact right week.
Good.
I've had such a good writing week because I've been working on this manuscript for, I even checked because I always write I started in a hardcover, so I was writing the cover of the hardcover when I started. And it felt like a long time ago. And I checked, it was September 2024 I started this novel. And I finished it yesterday, the rough draft.
Oh, wow.
And earlier in the week, I had two kind of new ideas. And one was for the ending. And so the ending has changed and become something I'm very excited about. So today, after we finish here, and next week, I need to go back and kind of sort some of the things in the rough draft. But yeah, it's been a great, great writing week.
That's great to hear. And what does that look like for you? Because you are a full-time, you're a career writer, aren't you? That's how you make your living. You write for a living. So what does that look like in terms of daily process?
Yeah. You know, I'm a working class girl. So for me, I work Monday to Friday. I go to my office in the morning. I knock off about 6:30. Before COVID, I think I was more productive. I don't know. Something has happened that my mornings are very full of things. Like so I normally get to my office maybe about, if I'm honest, 11:30. And then I normally knock off about 6. And yeah, the first thing I do is admin things. I usually have a pile of admin. And then, get writing, usually after about 12:30 on what I'm working on. Sometimes if I'm stuck in my manuscript I like to have a long manuscript going, but then also I'll just like, if I'm stuck, I'll just maybe check a short story that's not working, maybe do some edits on one of my many unpublished novels. I just like to keep working. I just feel if you call yourself a writer, you should work.
And yeah. in that day or afternoon of writing, how much do you aim to write? Do you have a word count you work towards, or is it just about sitting down and showing up for that time? What's a successful day for you?
You know, it depends where I am on the manuscript, and it depends how I used to be compared to now. I mean, I really am someone who likes to not start something until I've thought about it for a long time. And so when I do a rough draft, I can be very fast. I mean, I don't even like to say the word count because you might think I'm not a serious person, but I mean.
Come on, show off, tell us.
No, I mean, it used to be easy for me to write 3,000 words when I'm doing a rough draft. I mean, I'm doing it the whole day. It's not like people who have other jobs. And then, I mean, nowadays, I'm happy if I get close to 2,000. And, you know, some days I struggle. Like earlier this week, I had a day of 800 words when I was really, because normally when I sit down, like with this project, I'll go back to what I did yesterday because I do write very fast and it's quite ugly. Even now when I'm done with the rough draft, it will be horrible. I always tell people I like to have a terrible rough draft because I know I won't die. My body will just refuse to die with that thing in existence. So as long as I have an ugly rough draft somewhere in the world, I'm good to go. So yeah. But so normally I go back and relook at what I did the day before. And maybe if there was something niggling at my brain that I think earlier has to be fixed, I'll do that. And then I'll start with the new writing for the day.
And that ugly rough draft, when you've got it, what kind of a self-editor are you? Do you write multiple drafts or are you just tweaking and fixing things here and there?
It will depend on what the rough draft is. I mean, it's different for every book, I think. It's different for every book because, like this novel, it started out as one thing. Like, I really wanted to write about a woman. I wanted to write about myself, basically, like we always do in every single book we ever write. But I wanted to write about turning 60 and how suddenly, you know, you're just this piece of furniture that nobody is interested in anymore, and how, you know, we want to, you know, that morning of turning 60, and you're just like, okay, just a downhill, you know, rush to the bottom now. So that's what the book was going to be about. And with a funny, it's a humorous book. I've always wanted to be a funny writer, and I've sort of failed and got very serious. But yeah, it's a funny novel. And she has funny relatives, children. But then I got an idea, because I wanted to set it, okay, it's set in America. It's actually the first book I've ever written set in America. It's set in where I went to university, which is the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is a very, very liberal place, which is really very sick at the moment with the situation that's happening in the U.S. And so as I started writing, I thought, oh, my God, it's very hard to write a humorous novel in Trump world. You know, every day is another horrible piece of horribleness. And so then I decided, no, I'm going to push it to the next election. So it's sort of a futuristic novel, and I'm making a happy ending. Well, it was happy until I have this new ending, which it's gone a bit dark. But yeah. So then it became something else. It's quite different now. It's a lot more about some politics and just some crazy ideas.
It sounds a lot of fun. Okay, you have started to touch on it. So let's go into the next thing, which is I want to know your superhero origin story, where you come from, how you got to where you are. And I know in your case, this is quite a long, complicated story with various turns in the road.
Yeah, I came to Botswana in 1989, and I'm long not American citizen anymore. I haven't been there. And this is why, too, writing this book set in America is sort of a joke, because I haven't stepped on that country since 1991. And last time I tried to, they told me they'll never give me a visa. So
Oh, really?
I'm sort of like, yeah, but we won't go too much into that political. But yeah, so I came here in 1989, and I was a teacher, a science teacher for a long time. And then I had a business. And actually, you know, the thing about my life in general is that I really, even though my kids will tell you that I'm a planner, like a compulsive planner, but my life in general, if you look at it, it looks very haphazard, and a lot of accidental things that happened, you know, nothing purposeful. And me becoming a writer was extremely accidental. I meet people. I mean, you know, we all think we're posers. So I meet real writers who, like, were writing from the time they were like four. I wrote my first book at eight. I always knew I was going to be a writer. No, not me. I'm a committed generalist. I like a lot of things. So, but I've always loved books. I always loved stories. You know, I often say I was raised by wolves, but that's a bit kind. So I was raised in a very complicated household where children were, yeah, not that important. So I used to, like, I had books, and this is why I love illustrators so much, because I had books, and I would just look at those, the writing. You know, I didn't know how to read, and there was no one to read to me. But I would walk around with my books and look at the illustrations forever. Like, I was sure if I looked at the illustrations and I looked at those words, I would figure it out, you know? And I couldn't. I tried everything. And so when I finally learned to read, you know, in America, we did those horrible Dick and Jane books. They were just horrible. And I remember being in first grade, because that's the only time I was now knowing there was ABCs and all of this, and them teaching us those books. And I remember being furious, like, so angry. I was like, all these years I've been moving with these books, and this is what these words mean. Like, my stories were so much better, you know, about the illustrations. I was just so furious. But luckily, I mean, I would have given up books then, and I would never be sitting here, because I was just so angry. And then they took us to the library, and I found Cat in the Hat. I don't know. I'm sure you know Dr. Seuss's Cat in the Hat. And I, that was like, that was it for me. I thought the Cat in the Hat was the best guy ever. I love someone like that who just comes into the show and, you know, fucks the whole thing up. So, yeah, then I loved books. So the only way I can say that in any way that I became a writer was because of stories, that I wanted to be more inside the story in some way. But I never ever thought I'd be a writer. I was a science person. I was a toxicologist. When I came here, I was teaching science. I loved teaching. But then I had a, okay, I wasn't yet a citizen. And there was, and the teaching, I was working for the government. And the government said, you must become a citizen because you're, because like the rule in Setswana culture is that you must take the tribe of your husband. And I'm really someone who balks at anybody telling me what to do. So, like, if you tell me what to do, I'm for sure not going to do that. So I'm like, fuck you, take your job. Oh, sorry. Anyway, so, yeah, so I left. And then I was just at home. I had a computer. And I'm not sure of the year. I'm very bad with years. But the kids were small. They were still not yet in school. And my husband had bought me a computer, and it was uncommon for, it must have been like 94 or 95. And then there was a guy in Mahalapi, as this very charismatic Zambian guy, 100 feet tall. And he had started like a newspaper, a free advertiser, but he didn't have the right computer. And so he came to me and said, you know what, I heard you have a computer. Can you like do the newspaper with me? And then you can be half owner, you know? And I was like, okay, I'm not doing anything, just sitting at home playing with the kids. And so suddenly, and then he was out because his name was Mac. And Mac was like forever on his next hustle. So like he was done with that hustle. And suddenly I owned a newspaper. And then, so I was writing for the newspaper. And, but like, you know, local news, Kotla news, you know, fighting over a donkey, funny stories like that. And then we were changing format. And then, because it was tabloid size, we were printing in Habaroni. And then I decided, no, I'm tired. I would like have to go to Habaroni like 3 a.m. and sit the whole day to get on the web, because there was only one web in the whole country and all the newspapers were there. And I was like, so not somebody they cared about. So I'd have to sit there the whole day waiting for my paper to get on the web. And so I said, no, I'm done with this. So we had to shrink it to A3, changing to A4. And so like so many things in my life, I was very naive. You know, I didn't know anything. And I thought, oh, we'll buy a novel and we'll serialize it in the newspaper so that people will pick up the newspaper. Because there was another A3 folded to A4 newspaper, free advertiser in our area. So of course I couldn't do that because the business was marginally profitable. I mean, and I realized it's very expensive to do that. So then I just said to myself, okay, I'll write a novel. How hard can it be? And so, and I mean, both of you write genre. So I'm sure when I tell you what I'm going to tell you, you're going to be shocked. I had no plot plan. I'd never, and it was a murder mystery. No plot plan. And I would be like, because it was biweekly and the deadline was Friday. And then on Thursday, I'd be like, I need 1,000 words. 1,000 words, go. 1,000 words. And I just wrote it like that, if you can even imagine. And I didn't, surprisingly, I mean, this is why a lot of things are just by accident. I don't know. I have very hardworking guardian angels out there. And I didn't write myself into a plot hole or kill my murderer or anything like that. And so, yeah, so I got to the end. And then, in fact, that series is the Kate Homolimo series. There's 4 books. So that was the first one. It was called The Fatal Payout. So it finished in the newspaper. And then people kept coming to the office. They'd be like, I miss part 11. And then my manager, Tsepo, would print it out and hand them, you know, from the computer. Part 21. And finally, Tsepo's like, couldn't we just get this to be a book? Because this is very time consuming and we're tired of this. So I just look at the, you know, we had yellow pages by that time. I mean, this is the whole thing. I've just been so lucky and everything just happened so accidental. But anyway, I'm going through the yellow pages. I find Macmillan, Botswana. So I call them and say, okay, I have this book. How does this thing work? And the lady's like, okay, send to us. This, and then it got published. And then, so like in 2005, I got like 290 Pula royalties. I mean, I didn't even know I was going to get money. I didn't even know anything. And then, you must see the contract I signed. It's shocking. Anyway. And then 5 years went by. And then the book got chosen to be a set work in Botswana. And it's still a set work right now as I talk. And it's been like the most successful, one of the most successful books. So, yeah, that's how I became a writer. And then I just thought, and then, you know, like I said, there were three more books in the series. All but one have been published. The other one, the last one, which is my favorite, I've never given it to a publisher. I don't know why. But I really like it. It's like my favorite. It's called Claws of a Killer. It's about a serial killer at the University of Botswana. And yeah, but that's how I started. And then like after a while, I felt like we were moving. My husband was moving to a very rural place. He was going to be the headmaster. So we all decided to move with him. And then I left my business with my manager and I thought, okay, let me just see if I can make a living as a writer. You know, everything. I mean, I wrote everything. We wrote Wami Molefe and I wrote two television series. I freelanced all over. And I thought, you know, if I can make a living writing, that's a nice job. I can live anywhere. And then I was. And then the goal was to try to make a living writing fiction, which I love most of all. And now I mostly do. So that's it. Is it a long story?
That's an amazing story.
So, Laurie, if you were talking to a younger writer today who wanted to write books that were going to be prescribed in schools, either in Botswana or South Africa, what advice would you give that person who wants to have that goal?
You know what? For this, because I do have books in South African schools also, and I would say, first of all, at least for me, I had no say about it. I mean, I don't know how it's done. It's the publisher. It's what. And I think you should just write the things you want. Like the two books I wrote that are in South African schools, they're for grade 7. One is Curse of the Gold Coins. It's with Vivlia. The other one is The Second Worst Thing, which is with OUP. And none of those were written for school. They were written because I wanted to write them. So, and then, you know, somebody would say, like, both in that case, they'd say, Laurie, do you have anything that maybe for this age group? And I'd send, because I always have a lot of things in my computer, unpublished things. And so I'd send, and then they say, okay. And then they submit, and it gets taken. So I guess my biggest advice would be, don't write for the school's market. Unless, for example, okay, I'm being a bit of a hypocrite in the sense that, because all of last year, you know, in South Africa, they're doing a new way to teach kids reading, a completely new reading series. And I'd done something like that with Cambridge University Press in UK, like from the early reading. Okay, those books, because I had to get this training, we had some reading experts from London School of Economics who taught us how kids learn to read, how to make illustrations in the early days to support the text. Those books, yeah, those ones were written directly for a school's market. But otherwise, no, just write. And then it gets submitted and you don't even want to know. You don't even want somebody to tell you the kind of ridiculousness that's involved in how they choose. I've seen the list. I mean, South Africa, sure. I mean, anyway, it's laughable, actually. You feel sad in a way for the kids.
I'm very interested in, and you kind of touched on it in saying just write what you want to write. You don't feel in any way you have to write in one genre. You've written different genres, different age groups. And it feels to me from what you're saying, like any idea that comes into your head, you're going to entertain it. You're going to give it a try. You're going to write it. Can you talk us through that a bit? Like, how do you decide what you're writing next? When an idea comes, how do you decide which genre it's going to be in? Talk us through a little bit of that, what feels like a very fertile world of Laurie's head of ideas.
You know what? The way I do writing, I think, is very wrong. So please, these young writers, don't follow me, whatever you can do. I've just been extremely lucky, I'll be honest, because I've even had people tell me, you know what, Laurie, you maybe could get an agent if you would decide what you want to write. And the thought of that made me so sad that I was like, I'd rather just stop writing and do other things that I like to do, you know, because I like to be, I don't know, you know, I left home. I ran away from home when I was 16. I always tell people I'm still a runaway. And since I was 16, I've just been doing things my own way. And I don't, like I said, I don't like to be somebody saying you must be this kind of, like when I was studying to write this historical fiction, which I really love. And then someone said, you know, if you would specialize in historical fiction, I bet you could find an agent. And then I stopped, you know, it's like, but I want to, yeah. So for me, let me just answer your question instead of veering off as I always do. For me, I'll get an idea and then I think about it. I walk a lot. I swim every day. Those are my good thinking times. And I'll be thinking about it. And if it just leaves my head, then it was not anything. But if it remains in my head, then I'll just think about it. And I used to call it fiction pressure. It has to garner enough fiction pressure. If it has enough fiction pressure, then I must write. And then genre, not much of my business. I think genre is a kind of a marketing thing, to be honest. Because even my supposed serious books, there'll be romance inside. Sometimes there's sci-fi. Like even this one I'm writing, there's a talking dog. There's a ghost or two. You know, I mean, what will come. And then if it finds a publisher, it finds a publisher. If it doesn't find a publisher, it doesn't find a publisher. If it finds a publisher, they'll decide what they want to call it. Yeah. I don't put any kind of... It's just if it's going to go, it's going to go. And if I'm interested, I'm going to write it.
I want to talk about the biggest difference between you and me. When I write something and I find someone who wants to publish my thing, I will literally sign any contract they put in front of me. If they want my firstborn child on a plate, I will sign on the dotted line, because I am so grateful that someone actually wants to publish my baby that I will do nothing to endanger that. And that makes me very vulnerable. I have signed some stupid contracts in my time. And you, I know, will walk away from anything that does not serve you, and you will negotiate a contract until it looks like something you want to sign. So what I want to know is, have you always been like that? And where does that strength come from, and how can other authors kind of gain that strength and use it to their own advantage?
You know, I said, like, my first book contract, I just signed it. I mean, most of life, I've really just been quite stupid and naive. And I just learn in the trench. I always learn things the hardest way. Like, I can't just learn things the easy way. I must learn it the hardest way, always. And it sticks, at least. So, but for me, because I think, okay, one, I can't say what's special about me except that I can be quite troublesome. There are editors in South Africa who, like, there was someone I knew, a writer, and she said, one of the ones who edited one of your stories, she has a child at my preschool. And I mentioned your name. And she was like, oh, my God, how are you friends with that horrible woman? So, yeah, I'm not well-liked. Let's put it that way. But at the same time, I mean, you have to be your own advocate. I mean, this is your writing. And one thing I always tell writers for any contract, a short story, anything, any contract that somebody gives you, no matter, is their best case scenario. Always. It's their best case. It's everything that they dream of. Mm-hmm. So you really need to push things. Like if they say they want to give you 10% royalties, say 15%. What can happen? They can say no. Eh? So what? Then you take the 10 if you can. You know, you must look at it, and also you must be realistic. I mean, South Africa, South African publishers, I can tell you right now, living in Botswana, it's rare for my own books to get to Botswana, let alone Europe. And yet you'll find you've signed world rights. I mean, you gave world rights to somebody who knows 100% they can't do that. They're unable. Eh? So you really just have to cancel, and know that you have to be your own advocate. Okay, maybe you guys have agents who are good and everything, but I've never had an agent, so I don't know. But and also, they rarely walk away. But I have walked away from publishing deals. If they can't, they can't, and then we just say okay. I mean, you don't have to publish everything. You know, anyway, for me nowadays, especially, writing is about me understanding something better. That's really what it's about. I want to understand whatever that little thing I'm thinking about, I want to understand it better. And sometimes my brain, you know, I'm 61, things are busy in there, hormones are crazy. You can't always focus. So with writing, you can really focus. So that's my main aim. If I get published, yay. I mean, Fiona, I think you know, because you've known me for a long time. Getting published is very torturous. Everything that comes after, the marketing, everything, really something I don't like. So, I get published. Maybe you make some money. Normally you don't in the trade. And so, it's nice. I shouldn't be ungrateful. I am grateful.
I don't think you sound ungrateful at all. I'm very curious how you feel being in an unusual country like Botswana has served you. Has it been something that has helped your career grow, or has it been something that has limited your career, or do you think it's been completely irrelevant and you don't even know why I'm asking this stupid question?
What do I think? Okay, for just me as a person, it's been wonderful for me. I mean, I feel like because of my sort of contrary personality and my oddballness, and this is a huge white privilege deal. Being a white person in this village where there's very few white people, people don't expect anything from me. And they actually expect everything from me. I could walk to the post office, you know, maybe not Mahalapi, but at least when we lived in Lecheng. And a smaller village, you know, I could walk to the post office naked. They'd be like, this is my core. This is still there. And it's nice. I like having that freedom. So I think for me, the biggest thing in terms of being, I'm a working class girl from a very dysfunctional family. The idea that I would one day be a writer is just like crazy. Yeah? But because I live in Botswana, this person that I am, I felt like I could do anything. So, yeah, sometimes, you know, South African publishers, they'll be like, but you're from Botswana. We can't send your books to any, prizes. They're for South Africans. So sometimes I've been told that. But it hasn't really, really, really stopped me. I mean, who knows? Maybe if I lived in South Africa, I'd be famous. But I don't want that. So that's fine.
And if you lived in America, do you think if you'd stayed in America, you still would have been a writer? Do you think it would have looked different?
I wonder. Part of when I started this book, it was a little bit of like, this might have been my parallel life, you know? But I don't know. I really don't know, because I really left America like I do a lot of things, you know? You know, people are like, you can't run away from your problems. I am a perfect example of, yes, you can. And you can make a fabulous life leaving all of that behind you. I've done it more than once, and it's great. So I don't know if I would have been a writer. You know, I was working in a big toxicology lab with great people, and a job that I didn't like the job so much. The work was kind of yucky. But I worked with great people, and I might have stayed there just because it was in Madison. And it's really hard to be to get jobs in Madison because it's such a beautiful place to live. So I might have stayed and not become a writer. Who knows? I don't know. Who knows?
Tell us about your time writing for computer games. How did you get into that? How did you know how to do it at all? And then you walked away from it without a backward glance, which I've always found very interesting. But just tell us about that. If someone was interested in breaking into that line of work, what can you tell us?
Yeah, they weren't really like shooting games or anything. They're these story romance games. So originally I worked with a Japanese company. I met this Korean lady who was working there and she was desperate for people. And it was very, you know, there's a very certain way you must write. It's so prescribed. And I am a bit of, despite the fact that I sound like somebody who doesn't follow any rules, I find that when I started writing, I loved writing flash fiction. I wrote 400 words, 500 words, and I loved that tightness, you know? So in a way, I did like all the prescriptions, how you had to write, the dialogue, how it had to be, weird storylines. Like, Japanese romance is weird. And you just had to submit to that. So I wrote for Eugene for quite a long time. And then she got married. And I don't know, in Japan, it's like when a woman gets married, she must leave the work. That's what she told me. I don't know. So then I sort of lost my contact there. And I started working with a guy in Canada who I really loved. I didn't actually walk away, but I was about to walk away. His company went out of business. And that was during COVID. And, you know, my daughter was living with me. She was pregnant. Nobody was working. She wasn't working. She's a musician. Her partner was not working. So I was like the only one working. And so I was really doing a lot of computer games then, especially for my guy in Canada. But it somehow broke my writing muscle. It was weird. It's like after COVID, I couldn't write anything. For like maybe a year and a half, I did the artist way with two friends of mine, trying to get back into something really creative, you know. And it's only maybe the last maybe year and a half that I feel right again. I don't know. I got so much into it, but I felt like I couldn't leave it because we were desperate for money. And I was like making American dollars. I was rich. Everybody else around me was broke, and I was like bawling. So I didn't want to leave. I couldn't. And then I was kind of happy when he went out of business. And then I thought, no, I'm out.
Sorry, I'm laughing. I was kind of happy when he went out of business. Like, sorry for his life, but it worked for me.
he's a lovely young man. I felt bad. But he's like a tech person also. Like, I'd be like, this storyline is so stupid. Can't I change it? No. The demographics say wada, wada, wada. I'm like, those people don't know what they're talking about. This is a stupid story, but I'll write it if you're going to pay me.
I want to unpack something you said earlier where you kind of said, and then you look for a publisher, and if you find a publisher, you get it published, and if you don't, you don't. What does that look like, that looking for a publisher? Do you have a starting point that you always go to the same publisher to start, or do you look at the work and think, where would this fit well? And how do you approach a publisher? I know in South Africa how we do it because we don't really have an agent system, but you've also mentioned some international publishers as you've been speaking. How do you do it?
You know, sometimes I just will Google, or I get markets, you know, these markets come in your email, and if they say they're looking for something, sometimes I'll send something out that's unpublished, because there's a lot of publishers overseas also that don't need agents. Of course, in South Africa, I have a few publishers that like Vivlia. I love Vivlia, but it's also just an educational publisher, so I might send them something if I think it might have a use. Cambridge University Press was funny because there was a man there. I think I might have met him. when I was shortlisted for the Kane Prize when I was in London. A lot of things came out of that London trip. I don't remember meeting him, or maybe he saw me, because we did a lot of, talking different places. He might have saw me somewhere. Because when I came back, he was working for not Cambridge University Press. He was working for somebody else, an educational publisher. And he contacted me and said, would you be interested in writing some children's books with me? I said, yeah. And then we started talking back, and we kind of became friends. Like he had lived in Ghana, and, so he had like African edge to him. And then he was starting a new series. And then he was at that first publisher. I've forgotten the name now. It was one of the big educational publishers in UK. And then he left. And then he went to the second publisher, and they got swallowed by a big publisher. And he left again. And every time when he was leaving, and it was just like over like some years, like 5 years or something. And then he kept telling me, oh, Lori, don't worry. We're going to do this reading series. It's going to be nice. And I said, yeah, nope. He's called Eddie. Then not a problem, Eddie. We'll go together wherever we're going. I've never met him in real life, but we're like big buddies. And then he got to Cambridge, and then he started this big reading. It's an international reading series. It's read all over the world. We got a big Chinese deal the other time. And like I always get, like, there's a school in Bangladesh. Every year I do a podcast with the kids for one of the books. I have 8 books in that reading series. So, yeah, sometimes people just pop up out of nowhere. Like Jersey, this one for DAS, she read The Scattering, and then she contacted Penguin. And Penguin kind of was confused. You know, Fareed had left, and they didn't really know me. I really only knew Fareed. And then they like gave her the rights, and then she contacted me. I'm like, no, this is not how it works. I have the rights. And so we had a big like kerfuffle about that. And then I negotiated a much better deal than Penguin was getting for the book, I might mention. And then so now she's my publisher, and she's lovely. So sometimes people come to me, sometimes I send out, I get a lot of rejection.
So let's talk about The Scattering, your historical literary fiction novel, and also But Deliver Us From Evil. They were both originally published by Penguin Random House, and now The Scattering has a new life from the publisher DAS Editions. It's coming out in hardback, I think you said, and also possibly as an e-book. Now, those books are brilliant. I love both of them. They were both in their own ways hard to read and dealing with difficult subject matter. And you got a pushback that Gail and I are both familiar with as white women writers, where people would say to you, oh, you're a white woman, it's not your place to be writing this black story. How can you write this? What gives you the right, or whatever? I think it's something that was in the air a few years ago, and I think it is thankfully fading away now. But what do you say to someone who tells you to leave a certain story alone?
No. I mean, that is like the, I always think about, okay, a lot of black writers like to say, when I was growing up, I didn't see myself in books, and I wanted to include myself in books. Yeah, that's wonderful. But it's not my perspective when I was growing up, because when I was growing up, what I most wanted to find was stories that had absolutely nothing to do with me. I was looking for the way humans lived lives, and I wanted a lot of possibilities. I wanted every possibility that was not my life. So I think the point of fiction is to find, to walk in other lives. I mean, there's some quote that I always say, I don't even know where it comes, the thing of like, if you're not a reader, you live one life. If you're a reader, you live 1,000 lives. And that's the same as a writer, and in a way, I mean, sort of inside joke to myself, but I know I've told you this, Fiona. I'm writing this book of a white woman in America kind of for that reason. Like, people are like, you must write, you know, I remember one lady shouting at me that, you're just writing these stories because you, white women have no interesting stories. And I was just like, you know, woman, honestly, I could tell you stories for days about my life and they would be so fast. I'll never write them. So, you know, just shut your pie hole. But, yeah, so I'm writing this woman set in America. I haven't stepped foot in America since 1991. What the hell do I know about that place? But I'm writing it because I can. Huh? And then when if it ever gets published, people in America will say, what the hell is this Motswana woman writing about America? She doesn't know fuck all. Yeah, I don't. And that's why I'm writing it.
I think we all need to, I think you should have a little podcast thing you do where every morning you give us this inspiration and the strength. I really think it's brilliant. I want to ask still on the historical novels about research, because that for me is, you say historical novel and I wouldn't even begin to want to go there because it's such hard work. Talk to us about that. Is it harder work? How do you do the research? What do you do?
Yeah, you know, I really love researching. I really do. It's like I research even when I don't have to sometimes. But yeah, but definitely when I was started the scattering, because, you know, I started the scattering because anyway, I always tell this story and it's sort of tiresome. But we had camped on Shark Island with my kids and my husband, and I didn't know anything about it. There was nothing there, you know. And I was at Cape Town Book Fair and with Colleen at the Mojaji. I was volunteering, actually, at the Mojaji stand. And there was a woman, a very wonderful woman, Jane Kachabibi. She's late now. And she wrote the most beautiful memoir, Undisciplined Heart, a very thin memoir about, but it had so much Namibian history. Her husband, of course, is a very important person in Namibia. He's Speaker of the House. He was a big SWAPO member. He's an academic. And so she's the one who told me, do you know what happened at Shark Island? And I felt sick, you know, really, that we had camped there. And so I was just researching just the information for my own self. Because I was like, I'm a citizen of Southern Africa. How the hell don't I know this research? And plus, on top of it, I live in Mahalapi. And Mahalapi is where Kosi Maharero's people, the ones who followed Kosi Maharero, eventually settled. We have a very big Herero population here. And I knew lots of Herero people. I think it's like maybe his great-grandson was one of my customers when I had the newspaper. And so I was like, so anyway, I started researching then, just very cursory. And then I sort of, the idea of the story was starting to come in my head, but I thought, no ways. I mean, I'd been writing young adult and detective and kids books. I was like, this is way not my wheelhouse. This is not for me. But then I went to store. I was in Nairobi at Story Moja Festival. And you know, I love going to, you know, when I'm at, I have my panels and what, and then I go to other things. So I kept moving with this man. He was always like with me. And we were talking. And then I said to him, you know, he asked me, what are you thinking of writing now? And I sort of told him about it. And like, I mean, just like so many things in my life, just like chance meetings, accident. This guy was like expert on the German Herero War. And he was like, you should read this, you should read this, you should read this. So he gave me names of books. He gave me names of academics. I read a lot of academic papers, archives, and yeah. And then I just felt really empowered when I went home and I just started. And I've done a lot, like even especially, I have a historical novel that's not published, which is my favorite. It's called Fiat Justitia. And that one, I did a lot of research in the archives in Cape Town. And I'm telling you, anybody who is stuck and doesn't have anything to write about, you must just spend a day in the archives in Cape Town. I mean, I was reading the report of the court case that the book covered, one of the court cases, that, and there were the witness statement, you know. It was just, I mean, you really just get a million ideas. Even I was reading other things, like, because I like veering off. I remember reading one with some Irishman was sent to prison for stealing a coat because it was so cold and he had no coat in South Africa. I mean, I thought, this Irishman, what is he doing here? I mean, immediately as a writer, you're like, what is he doing there? Why doesn't he have a coat? Why didn't people take mercy on him? You know, I mean, you just sit in there and stories are just piling on your head, you know. It's I love it. I even thought of doing a master's degree in history. I'm still not, I still haven't stopped thinking about that.
And speaking of stories, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
Yeah, you know, I'm a little bit obsessed. I read There Are Rivers in the Sky. I think, have you guys read it?
No.
Oh, my God. No, my little sister. No, I thought everybody already read it. I thought I was late to the party. My sister read it in her book club, and it's this writer, Elif Shafak. She's a British writer.
Yes.
Yeah. And then I couldn't find the book for a while. And then I finally found it. And it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. And I'm such a fan of like those kind of multiple narratives and also moving back and forth in history and back again. Anyway, so I finished that book and I really was not wanting to read anything. But I had another one of her books, The Island of Missing Trees. So I started that a couple of days ago. It's also beautiful. And one of the characters is a fig tree. And I love trees. I'm a big tree lover. So I like when a tree is talking in a book.
And what can we look forward to next from you? The book that you just finished writing this week, do you think?
Will it find a publisher, Fiona? I'm not sure about that. Who knows? I mean, I got an acceptance letter. You know, I'm trying to build up a writership, some publishing cred with a pseudonym, Laura Riley, my mother's surname. So this week I had two acceptances overseas for an essay and a short story last night. So maybe Laurie Kubutile will be gone. We won't see her anymore.
Does Laurie Riley write completely different things? I mean, you've opened a whole door here. Do you write completely different things under the new name? Why the choice to use a new name? Tell us about this.
She's Laura Riley. No, I don't know. Am I ever writing the same thing? I don't know. I think, like I said, because of COVID, I got to get a bit broken. And I have sort of a weird thing about surnames, like, especially because my husband and I divorced in 2018 and then he died in 2023. So I feel like somehow my surname, maybe I should give it away now or something. I don't know. And then I feel like, what surname is mine? Like, do I go back to my maiden name? That was not my name. And then I felt like, because my mother was, she was mentally ill. She spent most of her time in mental hospitals. But when she was out, and she wrote a lot of poetry, and I remember when I was coming, I saw her, we got taken away from her when I was 8. Okay, I'm going into much detail, I'm sorry. And I only saw her for one day. Before I came, the night before I came to Botswana, she was out of the hospital. I went to see her. It turned into a crazy night. Someone nearly got stabbed. Let's just put it that way. And then, and the next morning I went on the plane and left, and I never saw her again. She died after that. And I've always felt like, and I remember that day she said to me, you know, I always wanted to travel. You know, she mostly lived in Baltimore and really had a very difficult life. And I felt like, anyway, I can use her name. And she can maybe live again in some way. I don't know. It's sentimental and it's nonsense, but that's what it is.
But it's also lovely and touching and meaningful. I love that.
Me too. Well, Laurie, I also want to mention your children's picture book, which is out and available now. Called Mr. Fitchelstein's Safari Company, illustrated by the great Elizabeth Pullis. Where can people get hold of that in South Africa?
Yeah, it should be in Exclusive Books. We did a couple launches there. We We did a launch at Book Circle Capital. I know it's there in Melville. And yeah, they should be able to find it, I hope.
So we want people to look out for the new edition of The Scattering from DAS Editions. We want people to buy your new picture book, Mr. Fitchelstein's Safari Company. We want people to look out for works by Laura Riley. Are they available in ebooks?
Nothing yet. I've only had two publishing credits, a short story and an essay. And the essay, I don't think I'll tell anybody about because it's quite personal. I don't know why it's being published. It's about the first time I fell in love after my divorce. And even the person probably doesn't like that I wrote it either.
Oh, I'm going to find that. I'm definitely going to find that.
But Laurie, it's been absolutely fantastic to talk to you. Thank you for giving us your time and joining us from Botswana. This has been magnificent. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much. It was fun, guys.
Thank you.
Gail, I've known Laurie for a long time. We are good friends, but this was your first time meeting her. Is she not delightful?
She is magnificent. I love that. I was so energized by her. She is so irreverent and funny, and I really, one of those interviews where I always expect to enjoy our interviews, but we're just delivered in bucket loads. I enjoyed that so much.
Oh, I could not agree more. And what in particular delivered for you?
So many things. I've written, you know, I make notes while we're talking and I've got a long list here. But the thing I have chosen to highlight is I loved what she said. So first of all, I loved generally the idea of the ugly rough draft.
Yes.
You know, it ties in. I think we talked a lot in this podcast about shitty first drafts and you have to get something on the page before you can fix it and those sort of things. But I love, she said she knows she won't die while she's got an ugly rough draft. And so she's quite confident she's not going to die as long as there's an ugly rough draft around. And I kind of loved that idea of only wanting people to see your writing when it's good and then being motivated. I think that's it. Underneath that is, and it's something that came through in everything she said, the life purpose in writing and mm-hmm. the joy of writing and the being driven by your writing and the idea of writing actually being the thing keeping you alive and keeping you well and keeping you interested. Because while she didn't say it as such, that's the underlying thing. I won't die because I'm busy on something.
Yes, yes, yes. And I sort of flipped it on its head, and I also understood it as, it won't kill me to write an ugly first draft, because there are some people who are so mired in perfectionism
yes.
that they feel as though they will literally die if they put something imperfect on the page
yes.
and they have to keep working and working at it until it feels perfect. And that is a form of paralysis in itself. And for Laurie, having that ugly first draft is animating. That's what gives her life. And she knows she's not going to die as long as she's got that to work on.
And she's going to fix it. And, I do think that is, there was a vibrancy to her talking about writing that I found very, very inspiring. I needed it today.
100%. And, you and I have been talking recently about where ideas come from, where do they spawn from, where do they come from. And one idea that I had not heard before is to go into, in this case, the Cape Archives and just read letters, diary entries, manuscripts, whatever is lying around there, and how you just disappear under a pile of stories and story ideas. She mentioned an Irish guy who'd been put in prison for stealing a coat because he was so cold. And her brain just started thinking, who is he? Where did he come from? Where did he go to? Why was he in the Cape? It can be an incredibly fertile ground for story ideas.
I seem to think that one of our other historical novelists has touched on that they said there's so many ideas. I want to say it was Penny Hoare. I may be wrong. Sorry if I'm wrong. But that idea that history does have so many stories, and if you go digging, and you will always have the next idea, because the idea you were working on triggers the next idea, because you will have come up with something in your research. I love the idea of that. I mean, I know I'm never going to do it. I'm never going to research something in an archive. That sounds like very hard work, Fiona, but I do love that idea.
I love it too. And the thing is that as much as we are getting from this, we know our listeners are getting from it as well. And I think we have listeners who will go to the Cape Archive and start sniffing around there. And we look forward to the books that they come up with.
Absolutely.
So if you have read Laurie Kubwitsile's books, if you have encountered her writing for children or her writing that's been prescribed for schools or her award-winning literary fiction, please get in touch, let us know. We are on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.